Hello everyone, and welcome to CRAMSurg, clinical research appraisal and methodology for surgical trainees, where we pick a paper fresh from the press on a hot general surgical topic. We review it for you, we present it for you, we critique its methodology for you, and provide top-of-the-field expert opinion and teaching on research appraisal and methodology. My name is Gio Perrin, and together with Professor Sababala Subramanian and Maria Digby, we bring you CRAMSurg, from the wonderful region of the Yorkshire and the Humber.
Welcome back, everyone. Today we'll be looking at a paper published in JAMA Surgery exploring the role of intrathecal morphine on top of TAP-LOCK in elective colorectal resections. And then we will be doing a quick firing review of the parametric statistical tests and correlation that we learned about in the previous teaching sessions. Hopefully this provides a brief recap and a re-demonstration of everything that we've done. I'll leave you to it.
Right. So, hello, my name is Pratik. I'm one of the surgical registrars working in Huddersfield Hospital. And I'm with Aman. He's one of our new F1s. And today we are going to discuss this paper titled Intrathecal Morphine for Enhanced Recovery After Laparoscopic Colorectal Surgery, a randomized clinical trial. This was published in JAMA Surgery in December 2025, and it comes out of China, and the authors are anesthetists and statistical people who are involved in this paper. So I'll hand over to Aman, who is going to discuss the introduction methodology, and then I'll take over for the results bit.
Hi guys, I'm Aman, I'm one of the F1s from Huddersfield, currently on general surgery. So the following paper aims to look at laparoscopic surgery and despite it enhancing postoperative outcomes, severe pain is something which is still affecting many patients. So the aim of the study is to evaluate the impact of using intrathecal morphine along with a transversus abdominis plane block at improving postoperative patient outcomes. So the methods, something I'm going to go over now. So the study design is a prospective double-blind randomized clinical trial, and the data was based upon data collected at Sun Yat-sen University Cancer Center across a period of 4 months from October 15, 2024 to February 15, 2025. And the PICO of the studies, PICO essentially is the population, which is the patients undergoing laparoscopic colorectal surgery. The intervention was intrathecal morphine. The control group is intrathecal normal saline, and the primary outcome measured is the QRR15 score 24 hours post-surgery. The randomization type was a simple randomization, which essentially means that each patient had an equal chance of assignment to either of the groups. And to reduce things like bias, we have an independent researcher who was not included in the group allocation process and was appointed as a sole collector of outcome data to ensure blinding. The pharmacists and the research staff who prepared the medications were not allowed to be involved in any further stages of the study, and the care professionals, outcome assessors and data analysts were blinded after assignment to intervention. So here's essentially a flow chart showing the stages of recruitment, randomization and follow-up. So we started with 325 patients initially who were assessed as for eligibility, and of these, 73 were excluded, 42 declined, 23 did not meet the inclusion criteria, and 8 had the surgery cancelled. So this left us with 252, which was split into two groups, 126 being the control group given the intrathecal saline, and 126 part of the intervention group. So in the control group, 6 were excluded, 3 due to conversion to laparotomy, and 4 due to conversion to laparotomy, and 2 due to reoperation. This left 126 in the intention to treat analysis and 120 in the pre-protocol analysis. In the intervention group, there was 126, 4 excluded, 3 due to reoperation and 1 converted to laparotomy, leaving 126 in the intention to treat analysis and 122 included in the protocol analysis. So this is essentially a table showing what both groups were given. So both had undergone standard monitoring, pulse oximetry, ECGs, and blood pressure monitoring. Both were given ultrasound-guided transversus abdominis plain box with liposomal bupivacaine. Preoperative flubiprofen was also given to some patients unless contraindicated. Postoperative nausea and vomiting was managed with pilonacetron and dexamethasone, and also postoperative morphine was given. Those in the intervention group were given intrathecal morphine, and those in the control group were given intrathecal saline. So the primary outcome measured was the QOR-15 score at 24 hours postoperatively. So this score essentially consists of a variety of factors, just including physical comfort, emotional state, physical independence, pain and support. And then secondary outcomes were also measured. So the QOR-15 score at 48 and 72 hours, the opiate consumption at 24, 48 and 72 hours postoperatively, the total intraoperative opiate dosage patients received, the NRS scores during rest or movement in the PACU at 24, 48 and 72 hours, the time to first flatus for patients, the time to first ambulation, supplementary analgesic dosages at 24, 48 and 72 hours, adverse events such as dizziness, nausea, vomiting, pruritus and hypertension, and the length of hospital stay.
Okay, thanks, Aman. I'll be now talking about the results of this study. So we can see the baseline and demographic characteristics of the control and the intervention group, more or less similar in terms of age. And with ASA, they only took one to three. And we can see like five patients in the control group with ASA 3 and in the intervention group, which is a bit different. And with regards to the types of operations, they did a variety of laparoscopic colorectal operations. And interestingly, the intervention group had more sort of operations which had ileostomies formed than the control group, which could be seen as a little bit bigger sort of laparoscopic operation than just having ports after at the end of the operation. But that was more in the intervention group. The primary outcome that they measured was the mean quality of recovery 15 score, and the intervention group had a significantly higher, which is better score than compared to the control group. And very small standard errors there in the parentheses. And we have got a statistically significant result here with a p-value of less than 0.001. Then the secondary outcomes, the QOR-15 score was found to be higher in the intervention group than the control group at both 48 and 72 hours, which was statistically significant. The intraoperative mean morphine equivalent was calculated and found to be were found to be significantly lower in the intervention group than in the control group, as also the morphine use at 24, 48, and 72 hours. That is, it was better in the intervention group than the control group. The intervention group also had significantly lower median pain score in the post-anesthesia care unit compared to the control group. The resting pain scores and cough pain scores at 24, 48, and 72 hours were also found to be better in the intervention group than those in the control group. The mean number of days to first ambulation was also significantly lower in the intervention group than the control group. The mean number of days to first flatus was found to be significantly lower in the control intervention group than the control group. And the length of stay was found to be similar in both groups. There was no statistically significant difference. They have also talked about post-operative adverse events and essentially focused on sort of anesthesia-related adverse events here. So nausea, vomiting, pruritus, hypotension, dizziness, and headache. And they found that the intervention group had a more incidence of post-operative writers at 24 hours and 48 hours than the control group. So limitations, they have reported some limitations that it was a single center setting, and they were looking at Chinese population with a lower mean BMI, and the optimal dose of intrathecal morphine was undefined, and they chose their own protocol for it. And then the results were limited to 72 hours post-operative period. And we thought of any other kind of limitations. It was a very good study, but we thought that the flurbiprofen, which was not given to patients in it was in which it was contraindicated, it wasn't mentioned later on how many patients on either groups missed this flurbiprofen, which could influence results, post-operative pain and recovery results in either group. And also, they did not mention when the questionnaires were filled. Was it real time? Was it by the patient themselves, or they had aid in doing that? Or was it a bit retrospective, which could influence influence the results, bring in recall bias? So, in conclusion, this study shows that the intrathecal morphine, along with TabLock, significantly improved post-operative recovery in rise in line with the ERAS principles that we follow in colorectal surgery, but with an increased risk of pruritus. Overall grade, we thought it was a very good study. Technical methodology, the good things is it was a randomized clinical trial with clear methodology, and the study will be replicable in most centers in the UK with regards to availability of the things that they used for the study. The bad things is a single center study, and the low average BMI, which in in the UK we find that the average BMI tends to be a little bit higher for patients who will be having laparoscopic colorectal surgery. And from the clinical bits, we thought the good things were that this could inform change in practice if it is not practiced at the moment, or it could help in standardizing practice. The bad things are the standardization of the dose of the intrathecal morphine is required. They didn't. They made their own sort of protocol, but we don't have a standard dose in the literature yet, is what they mentioned. Thank you. That's from us.
As usual, a brief summary of the discussion we've had about the paper. First of all, we discussed a few methodological issues that we felt needed highlighting. We started with the inclusion-exclusion criteria. The authors quite clearly say that they excluded patients that had the laparotomy or the operation. However, they are then evidently included in the intention-to-treat analysis. And we believe this to be just a misnomer. Those patients were obviously not excluded, were just not analyzed in a per protocol analysis. If they had been excluded, we felt that an exclusion after randomization in this context would have not been justifiable, as the patient did undergo the intervention explored, which is the resection. We also discussed the randomization methods. The authors states that they used simple randomization. However, this is in a one-to-one fashion, which in a pure simple randomization would not be possible. So we'll inquire to the authors about this. Furthermore, we discussed about the potential of a halo effect affecting the results of this study, and this is obviously always possible. And finally, we discussed about the clinical applicability of this. Overall, the feeling was that the standard of care that's most commonly provided is the intrathecal morphine rather than the TabLock. Therefore, adding the intrathecal morphine would not necessarily be relevant in a context like this. Perhaps we would have been more interested in knowing if the TabLock add anything to the epidural spinal injection. We'll highlight a few things to the authors, as usual. I'll leave it to the teaching session.
Today we're going to review a few bits and bobs for statistical tests. Particularly, we're going through a quick review of parametric tests and correlations. Usual disclaimers, I'm not a statistician or an expert in stat software, but I sort of play with stat software every now and again, and I kind of enjoy reading about statistics. This is a summary of what we have done so far. So we're going to quick firing through a few of these tests using an example. We're going to focus on normally distributed data today. So almost everything here is going to be about parametric tests, as we said. And we're going to do it with Jamovi. So I'll start by briefly introducing the project that we're going to use as an example. This is something you've seen before. It's a project related to my own most recent dissertation. I looked at papers published in a number of high-flying medical and surgical journals, and after finding all the papers that they published over a period of 1 year, I looked at how they advertise such academic content on Twitter. And I looked at each of the tweets that the journals put out, and I looked at how those tweets were structured, looking at the use of visual abstract, use and types of hashtag mentions, and so on. And finally, I attempted to determine whether there is a relationship between either the publishing journal or the way the tweet was made and generated, and the number of retweets and likes that such tweets actually get. And I use a number of statistical tests to explore that relationship. So we're going to draw some examples from that, and we're going to use Jamovi to show you how such tests can be run. So let's start with question number zero. We said we're talking about parametric tests. So when we're talking about parametric tests, Maddie, what's the most important assumption that we need to remember?
Normality.
Yes. So when we're applying the parametric test, we need to know if the data is normal. And how do we know if our data is normal?
And that can be visually through charts or a Shapiro-Wilks test.
Yes, correct. So let's have a look at how to do that on Jamovi. So this is the data set of my dissertation. As you can see, there's quite a lot of bits and bobs there. So the simplest way to figure out, I presume you can see Jamovi and the data set.
Yeah.
So the easiest way to start is to go on Exploration tab and Descriptives. And when you're in this particular tab, you can choose a particular variable you want to look at. So, for example, we said that I was going to look at retweets and likes. So, let's see all about retweets. So, very quickly, when you put that on there, Jamovi will give you a brief summary of your data set. So, we'll tell you how many data entries are there, how many are missing. What's the mean? What's the median? What's the standard deviation and minimum and maximum? You can do way more than that. You can have all the quartiles you want. You can have variance. You can have interquartile range. You can have skewness and kurtosis, of which we talked about before. And you can also have a Shapiro-Wilk test. You just have to check that little one there. And a Shapiro-Wilk test will come back showing you a statistically significant result when the data is not normally distributed. That is to say, that you should not use a parametric test on retweets. But because I just want to show you how to run that test, I'm still going to use the variable retweets. But we know we shouldn't use it because the data is not normally distributed. If you then want to check visually, you could use a box plot, which is one of my favorite charts. And you can see that this particular variable is so full of outliers, so full of outliers. And you can do histograms, you can do density, you can do bar plots, you can do all sorts of stuff. You can see it here. So if you're looking for visualization of data and how much outliers are affecting your distribution, box plot works pretty well. Okay. Right. We will go back to the presentation for the next question. Mandy, are you okay to take the next question as well?
Yeah, that's fine.
Excellent. So for our question one, we're looking at two groups. We're looking at medical papers versus surgical papers. That is to say, papers that were published in a medical journal, papers that were published in a surgical journals. And our outcome is going to be retweets. So in terms of variables, what do we have here?
So there's continuous variables, the retweets, and then there's two independent samples.
Yes, because medical papers and surgical papers are independent from each other. There is no sequence. It's not like I've tried something to make something better and then I'm testing again. These are two completely separate samples. They are called independent. And what parametric tests that we know you could use here?
The student's t-test would be appropriate here.
Yeah. If the data were to be normally distributed, the student's t-test would be a good choice. Tricky question. Do you remember who invented it? You can say no.
No, I don't.
It was Sir William Gosset, a master brewer at Guinness.
I knew there
And
were.
he published it with the pseudonym of Student's T because he was not allowed to publish under his own name due to strict copyright laws from Guinness itself. You don't need to remember that. It's just a little curiosity. Right, so very easy to run a t-test on Jamovi. It's there. And also Jamovi tells you that what you should do is an independent sample t-test in this particular case. So as you can see, again, super easy. You get your dependent variable in there, which is, as we said, retweets. And a grouping variable, because obviously, we want retweets from some papers and from some others. And that would be, in this particular case, surgical or medical. So you just pop that there, and there you go. You've got your independent samples t-test. And as you can see, this is statistically significant. You can also, and you certainly should, run a normality test. And Jamovi will very quickly tell you that, hey, this data is not normally distributed. You're using the wrong test. He's also telling you that another assumption is violated, but we'll talk about that one in a second. So I hope that's nice and simple. That's literally how you do it. Right, let's move on to the next question. Question two. So Emily, are you okay to take this one?
Yeah, that's all right.
Fantastic. So in this case, we've got two groups. We are looking at papers that were advertised on Twitter only with text. So sometimes they just write the title of the paper or something like that. And then they tweeted them again, but that time with a visual abstract to try and boost the social media presence. And the outcome is retweets. So, what have we got here in terms of variables and groups?
It's still continuous variables, but the samples are paired.
Yes, correct. The samples are paired because we have the same papers. They're published first as text only and then as a treat with a visual abstract. It's kind of like testing patients at baseline. When they're having their antihypertensive prescribed and then testing them after the antihypertensive. For each observation in one group, there'll be an observation in the other group. And they will be linked because they will be from the same patient. Kind of the same thing, yeah. So, what test could we do here?
Would that be a paired t-test?
Absolutely. And again, easy as pie. You just go there, pair samples t-test. And you do exactly the same thing. And you put it there. And then, obviously, because these are supposed to be paired with each other, you don't have a discriminatory group variable. So you just put both your retweets and retweets with boost in the same box. And Jamovi will run your per samples t test. And again, you can run the normality test, which tells you again that you shouldn't run this test. Okay, perfect. Any questions so far? Feel free to unmute and talk if you like. Otherwise, we'll just move on. To question three. I'll go back to Maddie if Maddie's happy to take this.
Yeah, go for it.
This time we are going to look at papers from six different journals, all the journals that were included in this study. And the outcome is going to be retweets. So not two groups, but six groups. What have we got here?
So that'd still be continuous variable, but independent samples and multiple groups.
Yes. So what should we do?
That would be an ANOVA.
Yes. And another tricky question. Do you remember who described ANOVA first?
I'm getting all the tricky questions today.
Guy with the tiny glasses. Fisher.
Fisher.
Fisher, Fisher. The same as the Fisher exact test. Very proficient statistician. And he used to work at used to work in agriculture first, and then he became a prominent figure in statistics once Carl Pearson kind of semi-retired. I don't think he ever retired. It's kind of like one of those surgeons that always come back to do a clinic or an endoscopy list or something like that, even when they're 75. Okay, so let's see how to run an ANOVA. Again, Jamovi makes it very easy. It's there. So we're gonna do as a you can do it as a one-way ANOVA or ANOVA. It practically they do the same thing. So the dependent variable is gonna be that, and our grouping variable is going to be the different journal, which is pop, 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 a journal title. Boom. There you go. And there you got your one-way ANOVA. As you can see here, Jamovi has already done some corrections. So we are working on parametric tests with equal variances. So we should use the Fisher one, if that makes sense. If the variances, if there is heteroscedasticity, of which we mentioned in a few slides, we should not use Fisher's, we should use Welch. And we'll do this again when we do the Welch one. So one-way ANOVA, super easy to run. And you can also get descriptive tables and plots, homogeneity, normality, and QQ plot. So you can get group descriptive, so it will tell you exactly where the weight of the difference is. Which is also quite good. Excellent. Right. So question four. Papers from different journals. Maddie, do you want to take this one as well? Although I pretty much gave you the answer already. This time we're looking at likes, not retweets. But in this case, the Levens test as a p-value of less than 0.001. So will you remind me what the Levens test is?
The Levens test is a test of homogeneity of the variances of different groups.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. He looks at variances within different groups. The vast majority of tests, like ANOVA, for example, Fisher's ANOVA, they do assume that the variance between the different groups is similar. Doesn't have to be identical, but similar. That's called homoscedasticity. When there isn't homoscedasticity, you should not use Fisher's ANOVA. You should use something else. So we are in the same situation as before, pretty much. But this time, what should we use then?
That'd be Welch's ANOVA because the variances aren't homogeneous.
Yes, correct. And we just saw how to do it. So you do it the same way as you do Fisher's ANOVA. You go on one way, and then instead of assume equal variances, you do don't assume equal. and it will give you the Welch swan. You still have to respect the assumption of normality. So Welch ANOVA can get past the variances differences, but it's still a parametric test, if that makes sense. Excellent. And quick one, we're nearly at the end. We're asking ourselves, are likes and retweets correlated? Well, you would think so, wouldn't you? Because, you know, if a tweet is successful, both retweets and likes should go up. And let's say that we're asking our questions with normal data. So, Emily, what type of correlation test do you know that we should use, we could use in this particular case?
Would it be Pearson's correlation?
Yeah, absolutely. Pearson's correlation is probably the first one that sort of was described, although it was not described necessarily by Pearson. And it does work well when the data is normally distributed. It doesn't if it isn't. Quick question. Does Pearson, a statistically significant Pearson's correlation coefficient prove causation?
No.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. It doesn't prove causation. It just suggests that there is a link. It's not like likes are causing retweets or retweets are causing likes. In this particular case, it would be the quality of the tweet or the paper to cause both, but they might well be correlated. So let's see how to run this in Jamovi. Again, super easy. You go on regression, you do correlation matrix, and you pop in retweets and likes. And there you have it. You've got your Pearson's correlation coefficient, which is nearly one, which suggests an almost absolute positive correlation and a statistically significant result. You can even have a correlation matrix, which will give you this beautiful plot, which again shows you how when one rises, the other one does as well. Bam, 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 bam. Super easy. You can also, if you really want to, for example, you're writing a paper, you can have your asterisks put there automatically by Jamovi and even a confidence interval. So, yeah, that's super easy. And I think we are heading towards the last question. Emily, do you want to take this one as well? Is that all right?
Yeah, that's fine.
So we are in the exact same situation as before. But in this particular case, we have not normal data. So data that is abnormally distributed. If this is the case, what type of correlation should we use?
That'd be a Spearman's correlation.
Yes, correct. And we said this multiple times today, but what test should we use to check for normality?
The Shapiro-Wilkes test.
Absolutely, absolutely. And by any chance, do you remember what trick Spearman used to get around the issue he had with not normally distributed data?
Yeah, it ranks the numbers instead of just using the raw values.
Absolutely. Ranking makes often a distribution that is not normal look much more normal. And ranking variables across your two groups allow you to then run a correlation coefficient even in absence of normality. And again, that's super easy to do in Jamovi. You go again on regression, correlation matrix, and all you have to do is just check Spearman instead of Pearson. There you go. There's also Kendall's there, which is what we talked about not last time, but the time before. That episode will be up and running soon, as soon as I get time to publish it. Excellent. I think this is over. Sorry, I kept you for a whooping 20 minutes. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in and listening. Until next time, keep coming alive with our search for questions.